The following audio is from Shiloh Presbyterian Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. For more information on Shiloh Presbyterian Church, please visit our website at shilohopc.org.
All right, so Matthew called me yesterday morning and said I should probably plan to teach Sunday school because he probably wouldn't be here today, and he was right. So I have a lesson that's going to go a little bit off topic, sort of. Off topic. But before we do that, we haven't had a lot of time for questions during this class. We're trying to cover so much material. Does anyone have any outstanding questions that they would like to ask? Was there a seminary before Princeton is the question, yeah. There was not a seminary in the main line in the PCUSA before Princeton. There was the first seminary, Presbyterian seminary, was the Associate Synod Presbytery in the late 1700s, I think, in western Pennsylvania. And then there's a ARP seminary that started in New York City, I think in 1805, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. But Princeton was the first in the what's now the PCUSA. And then I think maybe after that would have been Union Seminary in Virginia, perhaps. That was starting around the same time. At least Hampton-Sydney College started at the same time. Any other questions before we move on? Yes, gallery. Yeah. did Presbyterians create Joseph Smith? I think Joseph Smith's mother might have been Presbyterian, but I don't think he was particularly religious before. I mean, he was very young when he supposedly found these golden tablets in the woods, and I don't know that he had been committed to a church prior to that. And the Second Great Awakening is a lot bigger than Presbyterianism, even though like Charles Finney's a big figure and he's Presbyterian, but there's a lot of other things happening. And a ton of denominations come out of the 1800s. I mean, a lot of different movements. When he found the 13, when he found the golden tablets, yeah. So he was young. I'm not sure that's exactly, but... So I don't think there is a clear Presbyterian connection there, Dave. But it's just a very weird era. The 1800s are a very weird era for religion in America. I mean, later you'll get the Jehovah's Witnesses, you get the Christian Scientists come out of that era, and then I mean, just tons of the denominations. We have the Pentecostal movement starts to develop then. Right, any other questions before we move on? Okay, so Matthew and I had planned out for the Sunday school course a whole timeline that it was supposed to go fairly chronologically. My last lesson was a little bit out of order because Matthew was behind. This one's out of order because he was supposed to teach, I think, for three more Sundays before his babies were born. And that didn't work out. So I'm not exactly sure how we'll proceed. Matthew is going to potentially pick up, or I will pick up next week, talking about the old school, new school controversy. This is in the mid 1800s, and that is also going to flow right into the tensions between the North and the South, conflict over slavery, and eventually the division of the Northern and Southern churches over slavery. But we're doing a little interlude here. Interlude Scottish-American denomination. So what I'm going to talk about is kind of stepping back again into the 1700s, even the late 1600s, and talk about something we wanted to make more of a focus in the course, but these are the minor streams in American Presbyterianism of the Scottish-influenced denominations, which are, today we have predominantly the RPCNA and the ARP. There were more in the past that have have largely joined other groups at this point. So to set a little bit of context for this, so let me just clarify again. We're going to do a lot of time overlap of a little bit of things we've already talked about, but a lot of time overlap of things we've already talked about. So if you think back to things that are happening, these things we'll talk about today are happening in parallel to the things that are happening in what is the mainline church. When I was in college in Western Pennsylvania, I was relatively new to Presbyterianism. My family started attending Presbyterian church when I was 16. But one of the interesting things in Grove City, Pennsylvania, is there are two enormous Presbyterian churches 0.2 miles from each other, which at the time were both PCUSA churches. They're now in this split-off group called Echo. But they're, for a very small town, they're enormous churches. And it seemed very odd to me that you'd have two PCUSA churches 0.2 miles from each other. And I didn't know Presbyterian history much at all then, but one of those churches until 1958 would have been what's called the United Presbyterian Church, which the United Presbyterian Church we're going to talk about in a little bit is kind of the ARP of the North. And the other one would have been the mainline church, or the PCUSA church. And so when those two denominations joined in 1958, they became these two huge churches of the same denomination. But you really can't understand Western Pennsylvania, with Pastor Hughes could tell you, without understanding the United Presbyterians and this kind of sub-strain of smaller groups that move into Western Pennsylvania after the American Revolution. So this topic is also of interest to me. I mentioned a couple weeks ago my ancestors who came down the Great Wagon Road and went to South Carolina. They were, my great-grandmother was from an ARP family in South Carolina. They had been ARP for something like 150 years in South Carolina until she married my great-grandfather, who was a Southern Presbyterian, PCUS, and they became missionaries. And so it was kind of the end of the ARPs then. But it's been interesting to me over the last few years to try to learn more about that. So for you, you don't care about my family necessarily, but hopefully this lesson will give you a little more context as to why we have these sister Presbyterian denominations. We're members together of an organization called NAPARC, which is not a church, but a closely related organization of closely related conservative Presbyterian churches, the PCA, the ARP, the OPC, RPCNA, the United Reformed Church, and several smaller denominations. But these are two groups that are very close to us theologically in many ways, and even more so now probably than they would have been historically. But we're separate denominations, and it turns out we have totally different histories, which is largely why we're separate denominations. I think it's also helpful to hear some of what we'll talk about today as understanding. Sometimes it can be discouraging to hear about there's conflict that's happening in our denomination sometimes and other Reformed denominations. There are churches that are leaving and changing denominations or splitting off and starting other groups. All these different things are happening. And it turns out that's actually been happening as far back as you can possibly go, which is going to, I think I'm going to illustrate that today. And I mean, maybe that makes it more discouraging, but I think it, in some ways, hopefully it is encouraging that the Lord preserves his church even with these very tangled and complicated histories and histories that involve sinners and splits over things that don't always make sense. But finally, on that point, it's also easy. Enrique, could you help me hand out this handout? I only have 30 copies of this, so if people can try to share, I just didn't have time to make more. On the back of this is one of the examples of the Presbyterian family tree. This one's produced by the PCUSA Historical Society. If you look online, there are a number of other illustrations of this. Matthew showed a couple of them before, but looking at how the churches have divided over time, and it's true there has been a lot of division in Presbyterianism, as with most other denominations in America. But if you look, at least numerically, division has not been the predominant theme, but unification has actually been a much larger theme. So There are still a number of different Presbyterian denominations today, including several that we're very close to theologically. But numerically, at least, most of these groups that split have often united back in, and predominantly those have united into the what is now the PCUSA. So the Cumberland Presbyterians united into the PCUSA, the United Presbyterians, the Welsh Calvinistic Methodists, the PCUSA itself, which split at one time into four separate groups, has all come back together. And my point there partially being that, you know, it's easy to think about the splits and ignore the unity, but also there's a lot of complexity in that unity, because what is now the PCUSA is a very liberal church that's increasingly a more liberal church. And I think a good argument can be made that at least aspects of that liberalism come through uniting groups that shouldn't be united as the same denomination. If you force two groups together that believe different things, ultimately what you have to do is soften those views, which maybe hasn't been a good thing. But I'll leave that for you to decide. All right, so we got about 30 minutes, and what I'm going to attempt to give is an overview of these denominations, largely up till about 1900, and we'll see how far we get. I might not get all the way through it. Okay, so the roots of the Scottish American churches, we've already talked about, largely go back to two groups in Scotland. And we call them Scottish American churches, not that they're directly tied to Scotland, but these groups, what's now the RPCNA, what's now the ARP, in their earlier days hung on much tighter to their connections to their practices and their people who remained in Scotland or in Northern Ireland. So one of those groups, the Reformed Presbyterians, are also called the Covenanters, come from the Presbyterians who, in the 1640s, well, all of Scotland, in a sense, in the 1640s, signed what's called the Solemn League and Covenant, which was this covenant with Scotland, England, and Ireland to reform the churches, a pledge to reform the churches. And these Covenanters held on to this covenant even as others very quickly started to ignore it. The Covenanters, I mentioned this before, they started to meet in private groups called societies at risk of persecution and death. As early as 1662, they began to migrate to the colonies, initially to eastern Pennsylvania. From there, some went down to South Carolina, New York, western Pennsylvania. The first known Covenanter congregation was established in Pennsylvania, kind of outside Lancaster area in the 1740s. And by 1774, so right on the brink of the American Revolution, there were four ministers who had come from Scotland and Ireland, and they constituted a Reformed Presbytery. Before that, I'm going to step back, and I only have a few slides today, but I wanted to go ahead and show those to set a little bit of context. And the context is that geography is really important here. Sorry, this is a little bit hard to see. It's a little bit small. But this is just a picture from a book. Those little stars up there at the top are these RP and ARP congregations in New York and Vermont. They're kind of up along the Hudson River. So that some of them went up that direction. Later, this is this doesn't have the date, but as people start to move out to Ohio, they settle. You can see down there in the south. West of Ohio, as well as along the eastern border, just over from western Pennsylvania. So those little dots and plus signs are these congregations. Western Pennsylvania is much more prominent. You can especially see this is western Pennsylvania. Grove City, Pennsylvania, where I went to college, is right around here. But you just have western Pennsylvania is just full of these churches that are what are now RPCNA, ARP churches, as well as, you know, some scattered back as they moved across from Philadelphia. And then this is South Carolina, and North Carolina a little bit, North Charlotte area, as well as down into South Carolina. These are churches by as of 1790, and then even into Georgia. Okay, so, and then one final map. This map is ARP congregations today in the Charlotte area. You may know in Wake County we have two ARP congregations. If you look here, Mecklenburg County has, you know, what, 30 ARP congregations. And that full area, the Charlotte area, is really where the ARPs started to congregate. So that's to give a little bit of context for what we're going to talk about here. I'm just going to put it back on that. Okay, so the Covenanters in 1774 formed a Reformed Presbytery in North America. Because a new nation had been formed after that, 1776, and as the revolution ends, many of these Covenanters started to feel like they were no longer bound to the Solemn League and Covenant, as well as the National Covenant, which had predated it. So they're in a new nation, so their covenant to reform the churches of the nation maybe no longer applied. So in 1782, right at the end of the American Revolution, the majority of the Reformed Presbyterians, which was only about 600 people, so a pretty small group, joined with their sister denomination, the Associate Presbytery, which was a group they agreed with on most things other than covenanting. And they have formed what is what's called the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Synod, so, or maybe presbytery initially. Associate from the Associate group, who we'll talk about in a second, Reformed from the Reformed Presbyterian group, and they just combined the names. A remnant of these people and congregations believe this union required too many concessions, and through the support of some ministers sent from Ireland and Scotland, they would form a new Reformed Presbytery in 1798, there's this thing that often happens when two denominations join, you end up with three denominations. The joint denominations and then the people who stay out of the two. So that happens here. So some of the Reformed stay out and form this new Reformed Presbytery, which is then going to lead up to the modern RPCNA. For that group, the group that stayed out, because the United States Constitution made no reference or claim of the lordship of Christ over the nation of the United States, the Covenanters believe they were required to dissent from kind of political involvement with the United States because essentially they thought the United States was an illegitimate nation because it didn't acknowledge the lordship of Christ. So they wouldn't, for example, hold office and they wouldn't vote. The RPs, as they continued to what we have in the modern RPCNA, formally held this view until the 1960s, where they wouldn't vote, they wouldn't hold office, sometimes wouldn't serve in the military. So that's the RPs, the Covenanters. There's another group called the Associate Presbyterians, or the Seceders. They start in Scotland as well, a little bit later than the Covenanters. In 1732, the General Assembly, I think I mentioned this, Matthew may have mentioned this, the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland passed a new law basically prohibiting churches from selecting their ministers and giving that authority to the wealthy landowners and civil leaders instead of the congregation. Ebenezer Erskine, a name you've probably heard, was a minister in Scotland, wished to have his dissenting vote recorded in the General Assembly. He opposed this decision and wanted to have his vote recorded, which is a common thing in our church courts. His request was refused because of a change to the rules several years before. And as a result, he preached a sermon against the ungodly, what he believed to be the ungodly decision of this synod. The synod sends a committee to speak with Erskine and make him aware of his offenses and tell him he shouldn't have preached a sermon against the mistakes of the synod. And they voted to censure him, to basically discipline him for how he was acting. Erskine appealed this censure to the General Assembly, and then they refused at the meeting of the General Assembly to let him read a formal protest that he had written, and he and three other ministers leave the General Assembly meeting. This is in 1732, and they form they go on to form a new denomination called the Associate Synod. That's in 1733. 1733, that happens. 9 years later, there's the first Associate Synod Church in the colonies near Harrisburg and Hershey, Pennsylvania. And by the time of the American Revolution, the Associate Synod in the colonies has 13 ministers. There's a complexity that gets thrown in there. So that the synod, the Associate Synod, is formed in 1933 in Scotland. In 1947, the Associate Synod divides. They have a conflict over something called the Burgess Oath. So a Burgess was basically like a local leader of a borough in Scotland. And there was an oath that was required to take office, and the Synod divided over whether or not it was valid for Christians to take this oath. And so listen to this. This is part of the oath, and see if you know why some of them, the anti-Burgesses, they were called, didn't like this oath. "Here I protest before God and your lordship that I profess and allow with my heart the true religion presently professed within this realm and authorized by laws thereof. I shall abide..." I have a typo here. "Something, abide something and defend the same to my life's ends, renouncing the Roman religion called papistry." So that sounds like a very Christian thing, right? Here I am professing the true religion within this realm and saying I won't be Catholic and I'll defend against Catholicism. Why might some have objected to that? Any guesses? It doesn't mention Jesus, although that wasn't necessarily the issue. That's a good observation. So the concern was over this phrase, true religion. So the Associate Synod had left the Church of Scotland, which is the state church, or the established church, and they are now, to take office, supposed to swear that I'll uphold the true religion of this nation, which is the established church, is the Church of Scotland, which they're objecting to this Church of Scotland. So the anti-Burgess has said, we can't call what's going on in Scotland true religion because the Church of Scotland is wrong, essentially. The anti-Burger, they were called the Burger Oath over the office of Burgess. So Ralph and Ebenezer Erskine, who were two of the founders of the ARP, they were in the Burger Party, which is the party willing to take the oath. Interesting story. Ebenezer Erskine's son-in-law, James, was in the anti-Burger Party, and he goes to the Synod meeting where they are, it's all coming to a head, at the meeting they excommunicated the Erskines and the other Burger Party members. When James goes home, he's greeted by his wife, who's the daughter of the minister they had just excommunicated. And according to the story, she greets him and says, "Well," and this is a quote from a book, "he was silent. She followed him into his study and repeated her query. Well, after a long pause, he replied, we have excommunicated them. And she replied to him, you have excommunicated my father and my uncle. You are my husband, but never more shall you be minister of mine." Supposedly for the rest of her life, she attends an anti-Burger church and refuses to attend her husband's church. So, and the book goes on to say he helped her onto her horse every Sabbath day to get to church. So, this divide remained in Scotland for 70 years, but mostly mentioning this because this is a complicated thing in the colonies, because you have these Associate Synod people coming to the colonies. They're divided over this oath that only makes sense in Scotland, right? There's no Burger oath that has to be taken in the colony. So they have this awkward division where they're fighting about something that is completely irrelevant in the colonies. And as a result, they largely start to unite pretty quickly, which upsets some in Scotland. So now we have in the colonies the Associate Synod and the Reformed Synod. They're essentially identical, and they consider themselves more faithful, more strict Presbyterians in what was emerging as the mainline church, or what's now the PCUSA. They thought the mainline church was too friendly with Congregationalists, which which proved to be true as we talked about. Matthew talked about last week. They were practiced what's called closed communion, so you could only take communion in the church if you were a member of the church. It's not, as we say here, if you're a member of in good standing of a Bible-believing church or something similar. They also, both groups were very opposed to what's called occasional hearing, and it's a little bit unclear as to how people define occasional hearing, but in the strictest sense, occasional hearing is you shouldn't be going to another church of another denomination because that's an unfaithful church. A looser form of it might just be you shouldn't be going to a heterodox church. Like in this era, we started to have Trinitarian controversies. You shouldn't be going to worshiping in a Unitarian church, which seems pretty obvious. But they were very strict about where people were allowed to worship. They're also much more, both groups are much more staunch on just singing psalms from the 1650 Psalter, where some of the mainline churches started to sing Isaac Watts's renditions of the psalms. Okay, so in 1782, these associate synod, the Covenanters formed the ARP, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. From about 1,500 seceders or associate synod and 600 Covenanters, and as we already mentioned, some of the associate synod then is also going to stay out and continue as a separate group. So union of two groups ends up with three groups. What I gave you on the front page of your handout was just a cheat sheet so you can try to keep some of this stuff straight that I prepared for you this morning. So the initial ARP is divided into three presbyteries, one for central and western Pennsylvania, one for kind of the Philadelphia area and the lands to the south, which goes down to South Carolina, and one for New York, and it even extends up into Canada. By 1802, the ARP had grown to about 5,000 members and was divided into four regional synods. So you have the Synod of New York, Synod of Pennsylvania, Synod of the West, or the Scioto Synod, which ends up being like Ohio and Kentucky, and then you have the ARP Synod of the South. The churches in the South, so that's 1802, you have four synods. The churches in the South resented the long distance they would have to travel, probably by horseback, to get to synod meetings. That was also a problem in Ohio and Kentucky, maybe going to synod meeting in Philadelphia or something, or New York City. Those groups, the further out groups, also started to grow concerned about the laxity of in the Presbytery of New York. And in a prominent case there was a case of someone called John Mason. John Mason was an early, very prominent ARP minister in New York City. There were two ARP churches in New York City at the time. In 1805, he founded the first ARP seminary, which is in New York City. At least according to one account, he resigned from the church that he was at when they refused to provide him an assistant or expand the church building according to his plans. He formed a third ARP congregation in New York City, which didn't have a building to meet in, so they met in a PCUSA church building in the afternoon. Some of the people from the PCUSA church started to stay after and attend the services at John Mason's ARP congregation, and John Mason started to serve communion to those people, but the ARP believed in closed communion, so you had to be a member of their, at least their denomination, if not their congregation, to partake in communion. So he was violating the principle of closed communion. He also started to preach occasionally in this PCUSA church, and he would lead the church in singing Isaac Watts' hymns, or at least his psalm renditions. So the Synod of the West writes a letter of concern about Mason. The Synod of the South kind of agrees with this letter, and the Synod investigates him, and then he does something which I've never seen happen or heard of happening. He gives a three-hour speech at the Synod meeting in his defense, which is quite an accomplishment. And then ultimately the Synod decided not to censure him. So he wasn't disciplined in any way. He actually later ends up leaving. He joins the PCUSA and ends up being a college president in Pennsylvania. So that's in the 1805, kind of going forward. In 1820, the Presbytery of the West withdraws from the denomination over this. 1822, the Presbytery of the South, or sorry, the Synod of the South does the same thing. They split off from the ARP body. So these four synods are now kind of two synods, but they all sort of still consider themselves, the three groups consider themselves the ARP. But after that, the Synod of Philadelphia, or the Synod of Pennsylvania, joins the PCUSA, so then that leaves the Synod of New York as kind of like the remaining synod. And then, so that's 1820s. 1855, the Synod of the West, so Pennsylvania, Kentucky, joins back to the Synod of New York. So then you have this, now you have this new ARP in the North, and you have this ARP in the South, the remaining Synod of the South. And then that's 1855. 1858, this newly formed ARP in the North, which is Synod of New York, Synod of the West, joined with the Associate Synod that had not joined the ARP in 1792. So they had continued on as their own church, the Associate Synod, and they form what's called the United Presbyterian Church, which is a very significant Presbyterian church in the history of the United States. It existed from 1858 when these groups join until 1958 when it joins the PCUSA. But as we saw those, you know, those churches in, this church I talked about in Pennsylvania, next to the PCUSA church, the United Presbyterian Church. Very prominent, especially in Pennsylvania. Some names you might know who are United Presbyterians much later on: John Gerstner, the mentor of R.C. Sproul. I think R.C. Sproul maybe started in the United Presbyterian Church, but he wasn't ordained until it joined the PCUSA. Jay Adams, famous for his biblical counseling work. And G.I. Williamson, who many of you would know from his study guide to the Confession and Catechisms. Okay, so that leaves us in the North by 1758 with the United Presbyterian Church. There's still an ongoing Reformed Presbyterian Church, two Reformed Presbyterian Churches at this time. We'll talk about that. And then in the South, we have the ARP, Synod of the South. And it continues on as the ARP. It eventually takes the name, drops Synod of the South, and becomes the ARP. So what we have today, all those churches we saw here in the South, these are the legacy of the ARP Synod of the South, and that's the modern Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. It's kind of one of the synods of the original church. It's the Synod of the South. And they've spread now across the United States and into Canada, but certainly predominantly in the South. It's about the size of the OPC. It's not a very, very big denomination. Okay. Just quickly mention, if you're not confused yet, that 1858, the ARPs in the North and the Associate Synod join. What happens when they join? Well, some of the Associate Synod still continues on as its own denomination. There is an Associate Synod that remains until the 1960s when it dwindles down to three churches and it actually joins into the RPCNA. So as we're following these streams, that basically leads us now with 10 minutes to talk about the history, or how the Reformed Presbyterians developed after the ARP was formed. So we're backtracking now. 1782, the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church is formed. A very small number, in the hundreds of people stay out of that merger and want to continue on as a Reformed Presbytery, or what we now call the Reformed Presbyterian Church. I think the main emphasis behind this was they were still hung up on the Solemn League and Covenant and this understanding of political dissent and how the church should relate to the government. So the Reformed Presbyterians felt like there were too many concessions being made in starting the Associate Presbyterian Church because of this issue with the United States not recognizing Christ as the king of the nation, or the lord of the nation. I've got to find my place in my notes just a second. Okay, so 1798, there are about 1,000 people associated with this Reformed Presbyterian group. They had gotten a couple ministers. I think one had come from Ireland, one had come from Scotland. And that was enough for them to establish a new Reformed Presbytery. So 1798, the new Reformed Presbytery is established. In 1809, they'd grown long enough to establish a synod. So a synod is just multiple presbyteries bound together. The RPs, the Reformed Presbyterians in this era, were a unique crowd. Their dissenting views were held very strongly and shaped a lot of things. They were also strongly premillennial. One of their prominent early ministers believed that the reign of the Antichrist had started in the 1600s when he believed that the papacy was established, and he believed that the reign of the Antichrist would end 1260 years after that, which would be 1866, and that would usher in the millennial reign of Christ. If you know what was going on in the United States, 1866, that was not the millennial reign of Christ in that post-millennial sense. This is not a quote from him, but from a book about him. All the nations would, at 1866, would consistently understand, profess, and support the true religion in all its applications. This was early 1800s. He's saying that in 50 years, all nations will support the true religion, which is very optimistic. McLeod said, "It is with high ecstasy this very period of the world will, a few years hence, be celebrated." So that was an influential view, and maybe could be argued the view of the Reformed Presbyterians in this era. Aggressively postmillennial, very optimistic about the future. They also were really one of the few, if not the predominant, Bible-believing denomination that was aggressively opposed to slavery. In the early 1800s, they say slave owners are not able to be members of the Reformed Presbyterian churches. If you read about the relationship between religion and abolitionism, there's a lot of really bad theologically liberal arguments being made against slavery. And the RPs of this area are an example of theologically orthodox group that argues against chattel slavery. Particularly, McLeod, who's the same kind of postmillennialist figure, publishes in 1802, Negro Slavery Unjustifiable, where he argues that Exodus 21:16 prohibits man-stealing and that chattel slavery is man-stealing. So why do we have so few RPCNA churches in the South? Well, that was a very unpopular view in the South, and the RPs either maybe join another denomination to become slave, to continue as slave owners, or a lot of them migrated up to Ohio and Indiana, where you had a predominant or a large RPCNA influence, relatively speaking, even still today. And you can go find that pamphlet against slavery online if you want it. I can send it to you, but it's very useful to consider. Even Matthew's, hopefully, or I'm going to talk about a lot of the racism that's entrenched in some of the Southern Presbyterians, and some of it's actually appalling to read. But the RPs were a very encouraging light in that era. In 1833, they faced their own controversy. So this is kind of the same time the mainline church is dividing over the Second Great Awakening and the old school, new school controversy, conflict over working with independent churches, congregational churches. The RPs have an entirely separate division, which is known as the Old Light and New Light controversy. This is rooted in the same principle of political consent from the Constitution. Conflict starts to occur with the War of 1812. Some of the RPs had never taken a naturalization oath and become American citizens, basically, because they objected to taking this oath because of their principle of dissent. So they were technically British citizens, and they weren't allowed to serve in the military in the War of 1812. Also, non-Americans were being told to essentially move away from the coast at that era. Some of the RPs take kind of this, they make this oath that they think is sufficient in making them citizens without affirming what they believe to be the ungodly constitution. And that starts to create tensions in the church. There's an issue over someone who wants to serve on a jury. And there's this, a lot of discussion and conflict over, well, do our local governments under the Constitution when that's like for the federal government. So maybe our local governments can be righteous even when our federal government is unrighteous. So that leads to this tension, and they divide into the old lights and new lights. Let me think about how to get through the 10 minutes of material in 5 minutes. So in the Senate of 1833, conflict arises over the former moderator starts to speak in the Senate. Some of the, I think the old lights kind of shout him down. They don't think he's legitimate as the moderator. Somebody talks about calling the police, and the old light men walk out of the Senate and form their own separate Senate. The new lights wouldn't join the mainline church, the PCUSA, because of their unwillingness to adopt the American modifications of the Westminster Standards about the relationship between the civil magistrate and the church. They talk a lot, all these churches really had a lot of discussion about different union. They talked about joining the ARPs and the Associate Reformed, but they didn't like that those groups didn't oppose slavery, at least consistently. Through these discussions, some of them split off and joined the United Presbyterians later on after the Civil War. The New Light group, which was called the Reformed Presbyterian Church General Synod, really declined through the 1800s into the 1900s, declined in size from 1868 to 1898, 30 years, they lost half their size. In 1902, they only had 36 congregations. In 1905, they consider union with the PCUSA again. In 1906, they consider union with the United Presbyterians. None of this works out for a variety of reasons. As the 19th or the 20th century progresses, they start to lose a lot of their identity. They start to sing hymns. They start to use instruments in worship. They loosen their commitment to Sabbath keeping, to close communion, and to church discipline. In 1953, they dwindled to about 1,300 members. And in 1965, they joined the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, which is not the EPC we have today. That was a split off of the Bible Presbyterian Church, which splits off of the OPC, which we'll talk about more later. But they form what's called the RPCES, which is most notable that in 1982, they join into the PCA at a time when the OPC also considers joining with the PCA. So mostly interesting then, like what we have in the modern PCA includes this remnant of these Reformed Presbyterian Covenanter group that goes all the way back to the 1600s in Scotland. Okay, I'm going to go for two more minutes, and I'll be done. So that leaves us the old lights. The old lights were the ones who were stricter about their political dissent. They are aggressively opposed to slavery. They also later are aggressively arguing for adding an amendment to the Constitution to recognize the kingship of Christ. Some of them meet with Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War to ask Abraham Lincoln to add an amendment to the Constitution and also to speak to him about the evils of slavery. They later form a group called the National Reform Association, which is predominantly but not entirely these RP men, and its whole purpose initially is to add this constitutional amendment. It later expands to a lot of social reform, like fighting prostitution, gambling, pornography, Sabbath breaking, etc. In the late 1800s, they split, and this could be a whole Sunday school in itself, but over a tension that is underlying so much of this, of their identity of, you know, what does it mean for us to be Presbyterians, Reformed Presbyterians, and how strict should we be, and how much should we be willing to flex on things that we believe to be more united with other groups. So a bunch of the young ministers split off and joined the United Presbyterians. That's also the time when they ordained their first female deacon, which was done without any authority to do that. And so basically the RPCNA enabled female deacons by this church ordaining a female deacon, and then the synod in, I think, 1888 or something, just basically declines to discipline the church for doing that, and that opened the door for them to have female deacons, which they still can have today. All right, so what remains of that after this kind of last split in the 1800s is now what we have today as the modern RPCNA. And there's a very interesting development that happens through the 20th century as they lose kind of this covenanting identity, the political dissent. They back away from a lot of the restrictions they had. For a while, they didn't allow church officers to drink or smoke. They didn't allow church members to vote, and they've really backed away from all that to where, this is debatable, but the predominant difference in the RPCNA today is that they're the one group that sticks to singing psalms exclusively, which was not really their identity earlier on. Even in the early 1900s, you would have had the Old Lights, the New Lights, the Associate Synod, the United Presbyterians, and the ARP in the South. Five denominations all would have been exclusive psalmist denominations as late as 1900. And that wasn't really the RP's thing, but now that's kind of their thing today.